Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm here with Sarah McDoolin. Is that right?
Yep, thumbs up.
Excellent. And JP, Josh Pomare.
Perfect.
You yes.
For anyone listening, there was a long conversation before the podcast about how to pronounce people's names.
And Sarah's, who I've been getting wrong all this time, which is brilliant. Good work, John. 5 stars.
I forgive you.
But it's at least it's both surnames. Like you always get the first names right.
Yeah, and that's the thing that matters, right?
Yeah. Josh is a nice and simple name that I can say. Yeah,
it's easy.
And we're not here to discuss surnames, though, are we?
We're actually here to discuss Call Me Evie, your amazing debut novel.
Thank you. It's kind of you to say.
Could you tell people listening a little bit about the book?
Yeah, I should be more prepared for this, by the way.
Nah, just fly off the seat of your pants.
What's the book about? So it's about a young woman, Evie, who... And if you didn't see me, I did air commas.
Air quote Evie. Is she Evie? Who knows?
It's about a young woman called Evie who is essentially sort of comes out of a stupor, and she's in a country she's never been to, in a small town, a coastal town. It becomes apparent very quickly that the locals aren't that enamored with her presence or... The man who she's with, Jim, his presence either, and she's not sure if she can trust Jim. He's telling her stories about why they're there, and something happens that makes her want to set out to sort of find what really happened. And it's a split narrative. It's a psychological thriller. Is that enough?
Yeah. That's a good introduction.
I need to be careful. I'm a rambler. I should warn you. I ramble.
But well, and you're in spoiler territory.
Yeah, the whole thing's a spoiler.
Okay. I reckon I hit about the third mark of the story, and I was like, okay, I'm going to start spoiling it.
And then you stop. I think that's good. I think that's a good descriptor of the book. And what I've been dying to ask you since reading it, because this book keeps you guessing and guessing, you don't know who to trust. Like, there's not a wealth of reliable narration in this.
Yep.
So you spend most of the book in this state of high alert confusion, like constantly looking for clues and stuff. Are you a plotter or a pantser? Because I can't imagine anyone writing this book without a very detailed plan.
Yeah. It's a good question because... it's something that is retrospective. Like when you're doing it, you're not thinking, am I planning right now? You know, you kind of, for me, it's a balancing act. I'm definitely a pantser, for the first few drafts. And I don't think, I certainly can't write in a compelling way, and I can't find any poetry in the language, and I can't sort of hit my literary stride. If I'm plotting and if I'm following a roadmap. So I'll have a point A and a point B initially, and this is with short stories and everything, and it's an act of exploration for a few drafts and just letting myself make mistakes. If I have to go back and rewrite and find where the story is, it's sort of an excavation at first. I'm just sort of exploring everywhere. And then when I've got the bones of the story, that's when I think I have my best ideas. I think that's when those first few drafts, I think that's when my writing's best in terms of the language. And I feel like any gems, I feel probably arrogant talking about my writing, but if you do find anything, any sort of gems in there or any great descriptions, that probably happened in really early drafts. And then I become a real plotter after that because I engaged a completely different part of my brain and I'm working out the mechanics of the story.
And finessing, yeah.
And it's just cutting away. And there's certain things that you really want to keep that aren't necessary to the story, which is a really painful experience. But I think the plotting comes after the pantsing. And I just feel like I'd be stifled if I really... really plotted it. In saying that, it really hurts because you do all this pantsing, you've written 100,000 words like 4 times, you know, cutting and rewriting, and then all of a sudden you've got the story but you still have to cut so much more, and then it's all planning. And So I think it's a combination of the two, but I definitely am a pantser at first.
So where did it come from? Where did this confidence come from? Have you written other books in the past? Because it's one of those most difficult things for an author or emerging writer to really understand just the value of killing your darlings. It is,
yeah,
it's so important. And you know, you're staring at it, you're going, I know what I need to do for the story, but I love this bit.
Yeah.
And you can tell an emerging writer who hasn't really got it yet, that they jam it in.
Yeah.
And just squish that bit in, and they go, no one will notice that. Yeah. And it sort of destroys the whole rhythm of the book. What I'm trying to get at is, how long have you been at this?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things to unpack there. It's a great question. The first thing is, I think I'm quite lazy, I'll be honest about that. I knew what was wrong all the time. I think most writers sense something's wrong, and it's, I think you mature as a writer when you begin to accept that you have to do something to fix what's wrong. I think lots of, you can be quite naive to the realities of how much work and how tight you have to get something before an agent or a publisher is going to be prepared to consider it. So I was certainly really lazy and naive, and I think what really helped was a podcast, speaking of writers, and you begin to sort of appreciate really how much work goes into it, and it's impossible to be so arrogant to think that you're there after a couple of drafts, that everyone's telling you to kill your darlings and everyone's telling you to tighten it up and everyone's saying you need, there's a certain way to go about it, and for me to be sitting there thinking no, it's good enough. I think that was a real sort of, that's where I really grew as a writer, is just becoming a bit more sort of savvy and aware of the realities of writing and publishing and how much work goes into it, and how if something's written well, it doesn't necessarily mean other people are going to enjoy it. It doesn't mean it's important to the story. The kill your darlings thing is just so important, but I think you protect yourself against that because you know it's going to be a lot of work. Mm. So you think, that's not me, that was them, that's most people, I can bang it out in a couple of drafts, but it's definitely not the case.
So you mentioned your podcast. Did you, how did that get going, for one? But also, like, Sarah and I realise that as we go through talking to writers, the amount of stuff we learn, we get free tuition. It's fantastic.
It's like little writing tips from all these amazing
people. It's incredible, right? Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's why I started. I was really surprised at first because there wasn't a hell of a lot in this space. This is three years ago now. So there wasn't, you know, there wasn't many Australian literary podcasts. And what there was quite produced, which isn't a good or a bad thing, but I noticed out of the States, podcasts like Other People's, Brad Listy and a couple of others, were the charm of them was they weren't produced and they were talking about the author as much as their work. And so that was my ambition initially. Lofty as it might seem, I wanted to, you know, plume the souls of famous writers, and that's not exactly how things kicked off. But I did manage to speak with a couple of writers I deeply admired. Clint Jennifer Down was an early guest, Oliver Mull, Sarah Barnett. Anyway, I'd read these books and loved them, and I just contacted the publishers and said, and then they said, well, look, I'll pass on to the publicist or I'll put you in touch with them. I happened to have been in some correspondence with Jen Down. And then that, all of a sudden, you don't realise how accessible these people are because you admire them. And it was also, I could do something for them a little bit. I know it's part of a publicity plan now, but at the time I think podcasts weren't as widely listened to in Australia. So I felt like I had to kind of say, this is what I can do as well. Like, I've got a modest listener base, but it's growing and so on and so forth. So the reason I started was that exact reason. I wanted that access. I wanted to know how they wrote these stories and how they developed as a writer and what they're actively doing to grow as a writer. But the one thing I learned really early on was everyone had the same sort of work ethic. Everyone had that same approach, that it was a professional career, that you had to work. It's not something like you write a first draft and then you live off the royalties for a decade. Like a,
that sounds nice.
It does sound nice. But I think that the one thing is I think you really romanticize writing, and doing the podcast, one of the first things I learned early was most of these people were working full-time, which was a surprise. I was obviously very naive. But not only that, they were working their asses off, like writing. So that was an early lesson. I think that was like the most important thing at that point in time I could have learned. I'd started Call Me Evie and I'd written a couple of drafts and I thought it was ready, but I couldn't be more wrong.
I remember it really blew my mind when I realised that most authors, even the really successful ones, have day jobs.
Yeah.
Like, it would be, imagine if we found that out about actors. Imagine if we suddenly found out that all actors had to also have a second job.
Yeah, it's the arts in Australia, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah, it's really... It's
yeah, because, I mean, even in the US, you know, a lot of writers will work as teachers of writing.
Yeah.
They go from university to university. So they're still doing other work. It's not just sitting back writing. I mean, there are great success stories where you've got people who've been able to free themselves. But how long does that last in a career? You know, you've got Danielle Steele who just knocks out 600 million copies. But
they're the exception to the rule.
Yeah, they're really the exception. You don't have that kind of... Like, you'll have a really strong career for 10, 15 years. And then, you know, because those sort of careers are kind of around a product. It becomes a product and people rely on it. Then the trend fades and you're left there, you know, without the same income you had last year because your book sales are going down because people have moved on from a particular kind of genre to another genre, yeah?
I just realised how strange this was for me because I'm sitting here in a podcast with two debut authors who are like, yeah, got to have a day job, teach all the scream. But, in fact, you don't know. You don't know where it's going to go. And you've written this ripper thriller and, like, it's getting comparisons to Gillian Flynn and all these people are, like, raving about it.
It's getting picked up overseas, right?
Yeah, it's really easy to be super ambitious about it because I've got an amazing publisher. I've got an amazing publicist as well, but it is easy to become really ambitious and excited, but absolutely I'm overwhelmed with crippling self-doubt and everything else all the time.
I think you've got to be to keep it good though, right?
Yeah, not only that, I think... You have to be surrounded by people that, I mean, it's not like you're a music star or an actor. I think in the back of your mind, you know, it's not like you're ever going to be able to just live off fame or whatever. You know that you're going to have to make ends meet for the rest of your life. Mm. And so people, although, you know, like my wife and friends and stuff are pretty... That they're aware of like the realities. They know that it's not a winning lotto ticket, so to speak. But you know, it's still difficult to be completely realistic about everything. When as I said, you get quite a bit of enthusiasm from publisher, which is a really nice feeling.
I could 100% imagine listening to this podcast again, you know, years from now, and just going, "Lol." Now you're running the world and you're like, I could see like your TV show's already been made. Like, I could see that happening. I also think, John, anything can happen for you. I just feel like I have to also say that.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting talking to, we got a chance to talk to Lee Child the other day and he has the same thing. He turns around after doing the book and doing the tour, comes back to an empty desk and the noise is gone.
Yeah,
and the self-doubt comes in.
The self-doubt.
And
honestly, we're talking to him going, you've got self-doubt.
If you're not doubting yourself, then who knows what you're producing?
That's like, you know what? It's both refreshing and, like, disheartening because it's, like, it's great, but also you'll never feel comfortable, you know?
No, never again. You have chosen a career where you're just going to be...
If you're neurotic as I am, it's not probably not that conducive to...
Can I ask about...
But you get more creative control. Like, that's one thing we do hear from authors is that, you know, you could have maybe, as a creative person, you could have pursued other avenues. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you would have ever considered acting or music or something, but with a book, it's kind of like you're the director of the movie and all the actors and everything.
Yeah.
You get to just control the whole story. And what else can you do that in?
That is a comfort.
Yeah.
And also, I've got friends who are musicians and things, and particularly in Australia, the writing community, especially in the commercial side of things. I know it's a bit more sort of cutthroat and literary, but everyone's super supportive and like lovely. I just don't think you get that in any of the other arts.
Well, that's what we found that with a couple of people who crossed over doing memoirs recently. They've gone, this book world's really nice.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
love hearing that. Yeah. Yeah, like some super famous TV
Jimmy Barnes.
Yeah, he's just like, wow.
Everyone's
book.
So nice to
Hello.
Each other.
Yeah,
like it's a whole other little entertainment industry that people don't always consider.
Can I ask about the affliction that you've sort of referred to here, of writing, being a writer and wanting to plan out that? Where does Josh come from? Can you give us a background and why and how long it's been desire to write? And
that's
Where were you born?
Yeah, it's, you know what?
Let's do the Deborah Caulfield on me.
I should be really, I should be good at answering these questions, but I'm not. And that's because
You
usually
ask the question.
Yeah, like I'm always thinking. Let me answer this question by saying I'm a Kiwi originally. I moved to Melbourne about 2007. I moved back to New Zealand with it because I got a sort of creative writing scholarship and I lived there for a year, kind of hitchhiking around and sleeping on couches and stuff. And then I moved back. Oh, then I went to South America for a bit. And then I moved back to New Zealand for a tiny bit. And then came to Australia. And I lived in Canada for a year. Throughout that period, I began to take writing seriously. So prior to that, I wasn't reading a hell of a lot, which is surprising to some. But if you knew me back then, you would understand. I read.
Sounds like you're traveling a lot.
Yeah, and I was a different person. I read a little bit of high school. It's that thing I've spoken about a little bit before. It's a sort of arrogance that you can do it without reading, and I can always come back to writing because I love the idea of writing, and I thought I had good ideas, but I'd never had the discipline. And when you're a teenager and you're kind of going through thinking, journalism would be easier or whatever, you sort of, you know, it's that thing, even when you're writing, you know what's right. You know, inside you know. It's whether or not you've got the kind of courage to pursue it, I think. And so I did really take writing that seriously until probably I was about 25, 26, around the time I started the podcast, maybe a little bit earlier. But I was always writing short stories and I was reading a book a month from the age of about 21, 22. And then when I was about 26, I was like, when I started the podcast, maybe a little bit earlier, I just was like, okay, I'm going to read a book a week now. I'm going to get serious because everyone's telling me you need to read more. You need to read a lot to be a writer.
Well, there's that famous quote, right? If you don't read, then you don't have the tools to write.
Yeah, the Stephen King quote. Yeah, and but not, you know, not only that, I loved reading. Everything was sort of a distraction. Everything else was like I'd start a book and I'd love it and I'd read it and I'm happy the whole time, and then I'd stop and I wouldn't read again. And I just get really bad habits, like computer games and drinking and whatever you do when you're in your early 20s. And I realised I was never as fulfilled or satisfied doing that. There's always a sense of regret that I should be doing something more purposeful or meaningful or whatever. And so I'd always come back to reading and I'd have bouts where I'd read a couple of books or a few books in a month and then I wouldn't read again for 6 months. And you average it out, it's probably about a book a month. And then I was like, you know, you love doing that. You know, it makes you happy and fulfilled. And I even slept better. Like, it just made me a happier person. So when I kind of realized that and started to read more, my writing got better. I started to write more. I had a few things sort of published here and there. And then I settled on a novel that I was really sort of happy with structurally. It was a lot more, probably a lot more literary, which was the problem with it initially. It didn't know what it wanted to be, but I was like, okay, cool, this might have legs, I'll stick with this, and then yeah, that's how it came about.
Is there anything in reading history that you read and you went and it really just went, oh god, I've got to write,
like a major inspiration,
like sort of unlocked,
yeah
yeah um All the Birds Singing, like, by Evie Wilde.
Yeah.
Which is no, there's absolutely no coincidence. It's called Evie. That book, without a doubt, changed my life 100%. Wow. And, you know, looking back, it is a great book. It's probably, it's diminished a tiny bit in terms of the actual story and everything. But when I say it changed my life, the reading, that initial reading experience, I think if I read it now, I wouldn't enjoy it quite as much. That initial reading experience is so powerful. It was literary enough, but the story was super compelling. It was short, it was fast. It was everything I wanted in a book. And I had written, I had this thing that if you just took a book and you rewrote it, you'll learn how that book works. But you just change little things. So I did that with like Cormac McCarthy and Murakami. Super ambitious, I know. And like probably the worst thing you can do to your style is try to ape Cormac McCarthy, because unless you really nail it, it's going to be ridiculous, which it really was. So, and then I had this tiny little book that had won the Miles Franklin that I adored, and I said, why can't I write like this? So I really deconstructed it. It's quite experimental in terms of structure. One narrative goes back and one goes forward. And, it's just really an incredible book. And I sort of picked it apart and I sort of rewrote it. And then there's certain parallels, definitely. In earlier versions of Evie, there's real distinct parallels, to the point that for a while I had one narrative going back and one going forward. There's a young woman who's in a foreign country, who's running away from something. There were so many parallels that really, I kept going back to All the Birds Singing, because, again, it was that profound reading experience. I wanted other people to have that when they read my work. So that was one book, absolutely, that just completely unlocked everything. And that's about when I started, I think that was 2014, Miles Franklin. I reckon about a year after that is about when I started Call Me Evie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Josh, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been...
I can't believe it's already...
I know. We've actually gone over time.
Okay. I feel like continue. I've talked a lot. It's probably
this is the whole point. It was just us talking.
Definitely what we want, but I just can't believe time went so quickly. I interrupted John's closing, so...
No, you can take it up now. I'm out. You've stunted me off my closing.
Should I... You want me to do the dismount?
Yeah, I'm going to sit in the sulk.
Josh, or JP Pomeroy, thank you so much for coming in. It has been a pleasure talking to you. And podcast listeners, you can get Call Me Evie. I mean, actually, it's not out yet, or it will be at some point.
You can order it. Anytime they can order it.
You can order it at booktopia.com.au.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.